Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, back after a week off, we're here till 5 a.m. Keeping track of the weather for you. That's the big thing right now. The winter storm that's making its way through the area is dropping a lot of snow out there. It's pretty crazy out there, and I think it's going to be a pretty interesting commute this morning during rush hour. So we'll keep you posted on all of that and more. We are going to talk about movie remakes, which, of course, now every other week there's a movie remake. We'll talk about the best ones and the worst ones. And that's all coming up. My dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. But right now we are back and we're going to review the movies. It's the Monday morning movie reviews. And we were off last week for Thanksgiving, so we've got 2 weekends worth of movies to review. Lots of stuff happening right now. Eric Childress, who joins me every week, and Jim Leskowski, who's filling in for Colin as he takes a couple of months off. We thank Jim for filling in. They are going to join me to review all the new movies. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. For talk and text, you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. So let's get the guys in. Here's Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
And Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Nick. Happy to be back.
Yeah, we're all happy to be back here. Stay dry, stay warm, guys, because it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, no kidding.
Pretty crazy out there. So anyway, lots of stuff to talk about. We've got a couple of weeks worth of movies to jump into. So why don't we do that? Let's see. We've got, Jim, why don't we start out with The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is the Coen Brothers' new movie, which I have not seen because I want to see it on the big screen, and I don't want to watch it on an iPhone.
I understand that completely. I think, in fact, it's exclusively playing at the Landmark Century,
right,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
This is the latest film from the remarkable team known as the Coen Brothers. May have heard of them before, but there is, just like you mentioned, a surprise here this time around, since their new movie is available to view on Netflix. And of course, they helped to pitch in the funds for this excursion. It's like we said, it should be seen on the big screen due to their impeccable track record and, just incredible cinematography. But I will say that it's a collection of 6 different stories set in the Old West, which is clearly a setting that the Coens feel very passionately about. Each story is separated as chapters in a cloth-bound book, which we get to see like a hand as it turns the pages as each chapter of the film is introduced with its title and a nice little color palette teasing an image or an incident to come. The showcase title character actually appears in the first story, which is the most Coens-like of maybe all the films, with its love of music and kind of violent outbursts and offbeat humor. There's a singing cowboy played by Tim Blake Nelson, who seems like he's going to be taking us on quite the journey that definitely has a lot of what you come to love about the Coens. Other tales feature the likes of James Franco as an outlaw bank robber, Neeson as a traveling show producer, Tom Waits as an old prospector, and Zoe Kazan appears as part of a wagon train on the Oregon Trail. And then we also end with the likes of actors like Saul Rubinek and Brendan Gleeson as among some of the passengers on this mysterious stagecoach on the way to a mysterious endpoint. So, yeah, you have a lot of short stories here that are expanded into different lengths, some of which feel a little underdeveloped, while others seem like they could be essentially their own feature. And there's no doubt that if you are a Coen Brothers fan, you will likely find a lot to appreciate here. They take certain elements of their last film, Hail Caesar, which was kind of episodic and even contained like a brief Western homage. And there's also the sensibilities of True Grit and kind of the darker existential flavor of No Country for Old Men. But in a way, it plays like a greatest hits collection. And like a lot of anthology films, there are hits and misses, at least for me. I mean, I would say that half of the stories are really strong. The best chapters in here give you a lot of profound ideas about the nature of existence while also being, entertaining and compelling. You know, half of them I didn't quite respond to as strongly, but again, a lot of moments made me perk up because I'm a true fan of these filmmakers. So there's no denying how funny the first chapter is, especially there's a particular encounter I won't give away with Clancy Brown that's really memorable. And I really felt that Zoe Kazan's story had a lot of genuine emotion, a lot to think about. And what can you say about Carter Burwell, you know, who just might be the best composer out there working today, and the cinematography, like I mentioned, is just impeccable. So like a lot of films this year, I would say, you know, I need to maybe watch it again, because, I mean, that's kind of par for the course, too, with the Coen Brothers movies, is that I might warm up to them if I see them a second time now that I know what I'm in for. But this one, in my opinion, is one of the weaker offerings to date, but if you love their style and if you love their human and how, or you love their humor, I should say, you can't go wrong. I'm giving this one a minor recommendation, even if I'm mostly in the middle on it, because like I said, half of the stories here really shine and the others, I kind of shrugged off.
Okay. All right. So that's The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is playing exclusively at the Landmark Century, but it's also available on Netflix if you want to watch it on Netflix. So there you go. All right. You guys didn't see Fantastic Beasts?
No.
Oh.
No.
All right. Well, I'll take care of that one. By the way, we're catching up on the movies that came out last week. These are the films that came out last week. This weekend, we'll jump into that in a little bit. But Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald is the sequel of the two Fantastic Beasts. It's set in J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. She wrote the screenplay. David Yates, who has directed, how many of these?
Since the fourth one, right?
No,
the fifth one.
Yeah, the fifth one. I think it's, I think it's five.
Yeah, Mike Newell did the fourth one.
And so David Yates has become the sort of the go-to director for these movies. This one, it stars, it's Eddie Redmayne is back as the character from the first Fantastic Beasts. He's Newt, and he's got a sidekick, they have adventures together, and he's obviously, you know, he's a wizard, and he has control over these incredible beasts, and Jude Law plays a young Professor Dumbledore in the movie, reaches out to Newt to fight off this bad guy, Grindelwald, played by Johnny Depp, who is opening up a war on the Wizarding World. And kind of all hell breaks loose, and creatures are everywhere, and magic is flying everywhere. And that's basically the setup for the movie. It is beautifully photographed. You can see the budget. You can see the budget in every frame of this movie. The special effects are, I mean, there's a CGI effect in almost every shot of this movie, and to the point where it gets a little bit much. And some of the sequences are exciting, and it is well made. It's David Yates. David Yates is a good director, and it's well made, and he knows this world inside and out, and is able to bring the world to life, like to make the feel of the Wizarding World come to life, to make the creatures look good, to make the magic seem exciting, and some of the characters are really a lot of fun. But the thing about this one is that it's, because I thought the first one was pretty good. I liked the first Fantastic Beast. I thought it was fun. This one is much darker than the first one, and also a lot less. There just seems to be a lot less interest in this one. There's not a lot of passion in it. It just kind of, despite all the flashy visuals that are happening and some of the flashy acting. By the way, Johnny Depp is really good in this movie. I know people were complaining about him, but he's actually really, really good. I think it's the best performance in the movie, quite frankly. And also, Jude Law is having a blast playing Dumbledore. He's having a great time playing Dumbledore. So anyway, despite the fact that there's a lot of flashy acting going on and tons of special effects and really cool creatures and all kinds of magic and excitement and stuff, it just kind of lies there. And I don't really understand why I felt like I was when I was watching it, but I was not excited by it. There was no real suspense in it. It's a pleasure to look at, and you know, and some of the you know, the magical effects and that stuff work really, really well. But there's no emotion. I was not emotionally attached to anything that was happening. It's too long, even though it's less. It's shorter than most Harry Potter movies. But this also felt long because I just was not invested in the character or any of the emotions going on. And while I just had fun looking at it, like it's a really fun movie to look at, and you know, the effects are cool and everything. And again, Dapp, I think, is terrific in it. I can't recommend this one. I was disappointed by it. And we're going to do box office a little bit later, but this is not doing well, Eric.
Not domestically. Worldwide is doing fine.
Okay.
But domestically, it seems like people are not as interested in this one as they have been the previous ones.
Yeah. And, I mean, and it just felt that way. You know what I mean? Like even in the because when I saw it, it wasn't packed. You know, there wasn't a sold-out crowd. And everybody in the theater, I think, just kind of felt like, meh, you know?
Right.
And that's the feeling that I get, like, that everybody has about this movie. And I have not read any raves. Most of the reviews that I've heard or read are very close to how I thought of it, how I felt about it, which is, you know, it just kind of like, all right. So I don't know. But again, I think Depp is great, and I think Jude Law is really having a blast in this. So, but that's all I can say about it. I mean, if you just want to go and look at cool stuff, that's fine, but there's really not a story to grasp onto here. So that's Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, or as Jude Law says in the movie, Grindelwald, and he's the only one who says it that way. So anyway, all right, let's see. Okay, Eric, tell us about Instant Family.
Okay, well, this film stars Mark Wahlberg and Rose Byrne as a couple whose professions they kind of, you know, fix up. They buy kind of rundown houses and fix them up, and, you know, basically, you know, they're flipping houses all the time. But the thing sort of missing in their life is a family. They, not that they can't have children, but they come across some brochures and stuff, and, you know, decide, you know, well, you know, maybe we'll adopt a child. So they go to an adoption service, and it was kind of like almost like a pageantry of people, of kids just all over the place, just, you know, hoping to be adopted. It's like a puppy farm, practically. And they come across a teenage girl played by Isabella Moner, who was in the Sicario sequel. She was the girl that Benicio del Toro was protecting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and she, you know, she's, you know, basically they're told that, you know, like, teenagers don't normally get adopted because, you know, they come with their own set of problems. It reminds me of the Defending Your Life joke that, you know, teenagers don't come here because they destroy the Tupas. but they, you know, they kind of like her spunk, they like her spirit, and decide that, you know, like, what the hell, no one else is adopting these older kids, why don't we take a shot at fostering one of them? Deal is that she comes with a package deal, that the adoption service does not like to split up brothers and sisters if they can help it, and she has two younger siblings, a younger brother who's very kind of a, you know, kind of an emotional wreck, very, very sensitive, and another younger sister. And, you know, they take them on, and it seems like it's all going to be, you know, roses and rainbows and everything. But, you know, there are issues. There's backstories. It's not all as simplified as they might seem. And so we have this kind of what seems to be sort of an atypical story about, you know, it's kind of a mismatched parenting, you know, coming to terms with how to be a parent.
Okay. All right. Hang on, Eric. Hang on.
Yeah.
All right. And then we'll get your thoughts on it after we break for the news. That's Eric Childress, and he's talking about the new Mark Wahlberg, Rose Byrne's comedy, Instant Family. So he told us what it's about. After the news, he'll give us his review. And we've got more reviews of last week's film releases and all the new movies that came out this weekend. And we'll do box office as well. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Glad to be back after taking the Thanksgiving week off, and we are here. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell the joke. We are keeping an eye on the weather. That seems to be the main story. The area is getting pummeled by a winter storm. There's blizzard warnings out there, and just be safe. If you don't need to go out, don't go out. That's common sense. and just take it easy. But we'll keep you posted on what's happening weather-wise. And we're going to talk about remakes a little bit later on in the show, too. But right now, we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5, and we're talking movies. Jim Leskowski, filling in for Colin Suter and Eric Childress, are with me. And it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Since we weren't on last week, we're playing catch-up and reviewing the movies that came out last weekend. Plus, we'll review all the new movies that came out this weekend. Now, before we broke for the news, Eric was telling us about the plot for Instant Family, which is this new comedy with Mark Wahlberg and Rose Byrne. And let's get Eric back here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. All right, Eric, what did you think?
Well, you know, movies like this, you know, almost seem to be advertised with the term feel good placed somewhere on the poster. It's just, you know, you kind of expect a certain amount of manipulation when you go into a movie like this. And sometimes that can be fine, and sometimes it can be incredibly grating. The thing about this movie that is really kind of unique is that it appears throughout its entire running time that it's just at war with itself about exactly what it wants to be. This is a movie that, you know, from the, like, the very opening frames when we start to get into the adoption stuff, it almost seems to be guilting the audience into not being as good as the Wahlberg and Byrne characters for doing this. They even have other, you know, parents in the adoption agency. You know, there's this whole thing where we get to meet all the potential foster parents, and some of them are, you know, are giving like really heartfelt stories. Others are used as punchlines and jokes, including a comedian played by blank on her name, Eliza something, who's used as a real kind of uncomfortable racial joke. She just wants to adopt a black kid because she saw The Blind Side.
Oh.
She wants to adopt an athlete. Okay. So you have, you know, these really kind of uncomfortable moments, and even the two adoption agency supervisors, who are played by Octavia Spencer and Tig Notaro, even they, constantly their dialogue is like sometimes, you know, like harsh truth and funny, you know, one-liner, and is just constantly at war with itself, and the audience can entirely being jerked around throughout this movie, and not the least of which is because, shockingly enough, this movie is based on a true story. And I, the whole movie, I'm trying to figure out, like, why was this movie worthy of a true story? There are thousands of people who adopt children every day. What was unique about this particular story? And the only thing I could possibly figure out is that there's a scene in the movie where the two of them confront a boy that they think has sent lewd pictures to their new foster daughter.
Yeah, I saw that scene in the trailer.
Yeah, and they confront him, and it's the wrong kid, and Right. They get arrested for it. And thinking, well, maybe that's what, why these people got famous, because of that. Because it's the only thing in the movie that stands out that would suggest that this is separated from all these other stories. I was really kind of shocked at the way that this movie presented itself. And, you know, from scene to scene, it's like, you know, there's a breakthrough, but then there's a setback, and then there's a setback, and then there's a breakthrough. And then are we supposed to be laughing, or are we supposed to be making fun of them? Because the movie does this scene, sometimes within the scenes themselves, and throughout the entire movie, I could not get on board with anything that was going on. It's one of the most frustrating, aggravating times I've had at a movie all year.
Mm. And this is the annual Sean Anders Mark Wahlberg family comedy.
That's apparently, yeah. And he hasn't made a good one yet, as far as I'm concerned. And they're getting worse. Well, Daddy's Home 2 is worse than this.
Yeah, well,
I'll say that much.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's Instant Family, and it's out right now. Okay. Let's see. Eric, Green Book opened last week.
It opened in like a limited release last week,
oh,
and then it expanded wider on day before Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to save that one for later.
Okay.
Even though it opened last week, I just want to save that one for later. All right. Let's see. Let's go back. We got, and Eric, you jump in again and tell us about The Front Runner. This one we've talked about. You saw it at the film festival, and it's Hugh Jackman playing Gary Hart.
Yeah, I saw this at Toronto. We talked about it a little bit. It's the story of Gary Hart in the 1988 race where he was considered, he was the Democratic front runner to challenge George H.W. Bush for the presidency. And people who are familiar with politics and history know the story that Gary Hart was eventually found out that he had an affair with a female staffer named Donna Rice, who in the movie is played by Sarah Paxton.
Yeah.
And Hugh Jackman plays Gary Hart. The film was directed by Jason Reitman. And the movie, Jason Reitman's kind of going, a lot of people have said this, kind of going for like a Robert Altman kind of feel. It's like he probably watched Tanner 88 a lot before making this movie.
Wow, I haven't heard that in a long time. Reference to Tanner 88, nice.
It's the first thing I thought of. But a lot of overlapping dialogue, camera movements, things like that. The screenplay is an absolute mess. It's a movie that, again, funnily enough, kind of like Instant Family, can never decide what it's really trying to say. Is it trying to say that that the press was somehow at fault for knocking down this great candidate? A movie that keeps telling us, Gary Hart would have been, the greatest president, this country has seen in some time, but never really gets around to explaining why he was so great. They just keep telling us, he'd be great, but we never really get a sense of his policies or, exactly why he would have been set apart from all the other candidates. The reason he got caught is because he actually defied the press to actually follow him and then was shocked when they actually did just that and caught him in these number of lies. And it's obviously, we're kind of just starting to get into this period now where they're going to see a lot of films that are parallels to what's going on currently in the country, whether it be fictional or real. And obviously, this was one of those big deals where it's this, should something like this disqualify a candidate? And the movie can never really quite decide what the deal is, whether it's demeaning the press or it's not really demeaning Gary Hart. Some of the stuff involving the press is clearly the weakest stuff in the movie. I mean, there's actually scenes within the Washington Post and with Alfred Molina playing Ben Bradley Jr., and those scenes are so cliched. Some of the acting is really poor. One of the actor who sort of is the guy that is dared, or he asked the big question at the big press conference about whether or not Gary Hart ever committed adultery. He's really bad in the film, and it just it never really finds a footing, and it's boring on top of that. It never crackles with any kind of wit. Hugh Jackman just gets to kind of scowl throughout the entire movie and yell at people for reporting the truth. So it was a real disappointment. I was hoping that this was going to be a movie that tried to make some sense of that period, but it doesn't really. It kind of goes right down the middle with it, and you don't really know where you end up on the side of this debate by the end of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for people who, don't remember, I mean, it was 30 years ago, but, man, it was a big deal. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was a big story. And I remember following it as it went along because I liked Gary Hart a lot. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he was going to have my vote. But as soon as I heard about this, I don't know why I find it really weird that Hugh Jackman was cast. I don't know why I find that weird. But every time I look at the scenes from the movie, or I'm like, why did they cast Hugh Jackman? And nothing against Hugh Jackman because I love Hugh Jackman,
right.
But I just don't know. I don't know. I mean, he just doesn't seem right for the part at all. Having I still remember all the incidents and everything that happened when I heard it was when he was going to play Gary Hart. I was like, wow, that's not the guy I would have gone to.
Yeah, I remember the story and following the story along. I don't remember all of the video and sound bites regarding to it. So I don't know if Gary Hart was quite as forceful as Hugh Jackman is during those real crucial moments in this film. But he's also a lot more handsome than Gary Hart was.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's a real disappointment because there are a lot of really interesting things that can be said and draw parallel. I mean, whether or not you want to draw that parallel to the current situation or even up to the next administration for that matter.
Yeah.
I mean, there are all kinds of things you could say, and this movie says none of it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the other thing that's disappointing about it is, you know, Jason Reitman made some good movies, but I think that when you reviewed this from Toronto, you pointed out that his really good movies are written by great screenwriters.
That's right.
And most of them being Diablo Cody.
Right.
It's kind of disappointing on that level, but also there's a lot of great people in this movie. Like, the cast is pretty phenomenal.
Vera Farmiga is wasted.
Yeah.
As his wife in the movie.
Yeah.
Ari Grainer, who plays the sort of the ultra-feminist reporter at the Washington Post, is given nothing but cliches to mutter. Alfred Molina as Ben Bradley, I think, is wasted. All the scenes of the Post, I think, are just like, well, we just had a really good movie about the Post, like,
yeah,
11 months ago.
And a great movie about the Post.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, anyway, that's disappointing. That's The Front Runner. It's out now. And it's about the Gary Hart's presidential campaign in 1988. Okay, guys, hang on, all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a break. Eric and Jim are with us. When we come back, we got more movies to review. One more from last week, and then we'll jump into the current releases. More movie reviews coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are keeping an eye on the weather and give you any updates that we have, and keeping track of the storm that's basically bashing Chicago, the Chicagoland area, especially the northern Illinois and lower Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin areas. So we're going to keep an eye on that, tracking that storm as it makes its way through. So that's all coming up. We're also going to talk about remakes. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to call in at some point. And there you go. We are talking about the movies. It's the Monday morning movie reviews. So that's what's coming up. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Let's get back to the reviews here. And we're still catching up. We were off last week for Thanksgiving. So we're still catching up on some of the movies that came out last week. Here's Eric Childress. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Jim, tell us about Widows.
So this is the fourth film from filmmaker Steve McQueen, who previously gave us Hunger, Shame, and 12 Years a Slave. This time he sets his sights on a genre heist thriller that takes place in politically corrupt Chicago with a rather memorable cast, to say the least. It starts with a botched robbery job that has gone bad, and Harry Rawlings, played by Liam Neeson, and his crew are essentially dead and left their grieving widows with absolutely nothing. We get a glimpse of the heist gone awry at the very beginning, which starts with a chase and then ends with the explosion of a van. And this, the $2 million payoff that blew up with the van came from a crime boss named Jamal Manning, played by Brian Tyree Henry. And after losing some much-needed funding for his campaign, he shows up at the home of one of the widows named Veronica, played by the great Viola Davis. And he starts intimidating her, to say the least, throttling her adorable little dog. And he demands that she pay back the money that her husband stole and destroyed. Jamal's right-hand psychopath is played by Daniel Kaluuya, who enjoys stalking and executing people along the way. But there is hope, because in Harry's safe deposit box, there was a journal with plans for a different robbery, along with incriminating pictures of a well-known politician. So ultimately, Veronica decides to enlist the widows of Harry's gang for her own heist to pull off. There's Linda, played by Michelle Rodriguez, whose store has just been dismantled by creditors. Alice, played by Elizabeth Debicki, who might be forced to, unfortunately, market herself to wealthy gentlemen. And in the far background is Amanda, played by Carrie Coon, who seems to be always clutching her brand new baby. So not to mention, they also need a driver for the score, and this ends up being Belle, played by Cynthia Erivo, recently so good in Bad Times at the El Royale. In addition to all these elements, we have the crime boss's opponent in the latest election for alderman, played by Colin Farrell, who is struggling to find his place as a successor in a long line of politicians, including his father, played by Robert Duvall. So how will all these characters kind of come together in the midst of one final score? Well, it does all culminate, and there are even some twists and turns along the way. So despite this being ultimately, when I first saw the trailer, kind of a straightforward story about, you know, some brave, strong-willed women trying to do what their husbands couldn't pull off, there are a lot of pieces to the puzzle, as I described. And for me, this ends up being a very good film that I'm just not quite as high up on as everyone else. I think McQueen does a really great job of setting up the pieces, and we as the audience get to watch it all come together. But for some reason, I wasn't quite as compelled the entire way through. I think the script by McQueen and Gillian Flynn, who, you know, previously gave us Gone Girl, maybe just needed one more rewrite to really stand out. There's something, obviously, I won't give away that occurs late in the film that I kind of saw coming, and maybe it's just because I've seen one too many mammoth films or heist films that I felt like I was, you know, kind of steps ahead throughout. But that being said, and I hate to sound like a broken record with many reviews this year, it's a very good movie that I just didn't think quite reached greatness, but at the same time, the performances here are really phenomenal. That's what really grabbed me. Farrell is great. Duvall is having a lot of fun, but there's also a really interesting subplot involving Elizabeth Debicki's character and Lucas Haas as well, who shows up and like, oh, wow, cool. I'm glad to see him back. But, I mean, like, I think Debicki is almost every bit as good as Viola Davis, who, you know, like you often say, Nick, is a national treasure in every way. She just commands the screen. So I can't say I was ever bored. I'm just sort of thinking that my expectations were just very high this time. I'm hoping a rewatch will make me appreciate it just a little bit more than I currently do, but I'm recommending it nonetheless just because of this incredible ensemble, and a daring filmmaker like McQueen just deserves his films to be seen. I wish I could say it's one of the best films of the year like a lot of people are, but I just think it's very good as it stands for me on a first viewing.
Okay. All right. You guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Jim are going to hang out. When we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought of Widows, and then I'll tell you what I thought of Widows right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. News is next, and we'll jump back into the Widows talk after the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time, and we're going to be talking about remakes, and we'll be tracking the storm, the winter storm, as it's blazing through our area here, and we'll give you all the updates and information that you need on that, especially as we get closer to your morning drive, which should be an interesting, really interesting morning drive. Mary Vandeveld, by the way, is going to be very busy this morning. That's all I'm going to say. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. We're doing the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right now. And before the break, Jim told us what he thought of Widows, which came out last week. And let's bring the guys back and find out what Eric thought of it, and I'll tell you what I thought of it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Eric, what did you think of Widows?
Well, I'm part of the everybody else that Jim was referring to during his review, because I do think this is one of the best movies of the year, and I say that as someone who has not really been that high in the past on Steve McQueen's work. I think it's, you know, kind of okay at best, most of his stuff. But this one, I think everything comes together. Everything just clicks in this thing. This thing kind of moves like dynamite. The performances, you know, are, you know, pretty much second to none. all throughout this whole thing, on all sides of the equation. And you know, I mean, I know Jim's going to give this movie a second turn, because I know that there are a lot of people that are making, you know, quibbles with the film. I have one that I'll bring up in a moment, but beyond that, you know, I think this thing, it moves like lightning. I like the idea that, you know, as a heist movie, you know, I mean, a typical heist movie that was just going for the sort of the pure excitement, the thrill, and, you know, I mean, the whole premise of this sounds like kind of a goofball comedy that, you know, we expect, like, you know, like Diane Keaton and Katie Holmes to be in, for God's sakes. But it's not. It takes this premise absolutely serious and gives all of these characters motivations for participating in this, not the least of which is the character played by Elizabeth Debicki, who I think is an absolute breakthrough standout in this movie. You know, she's been in, really been making waves the last couple of years. She's always kind of played a variation on the sort of same role, kind of a you know, an ice queen, femme fatale type of character. But this one, she goes through an entire arc in this movie that is just kind of bewitching to behold. Kind of goes from trophy wife to someone who's, you know, taking control of her life, but in a demeaning way, and then ultimately, you know, sort of being the, you know, one of the people that, you know, really makes this thing shine, really kind of finding her own. And, you know, that's, you know, it's a very powerful thing that, you know, this movie, you know, is, you know, advocating for, you know, these women finding their strength, finding their voice. But it's also, you know, it's not just about the heist. This is a movie that is every bit as much about politics. And it's perfect that this thing is set in Chicago, because we all know the stink of politics and corruption that goes through the city from time to time. But it also, you know, does some interesting things with that. The one sort of question I had throughout this entire movie is, how come the Chicago press don't know more about one of the candidates that's running for office by Brian Tyree Henry? It seems like someone might have dug into his past or his present a little bit more. Known a little bit more about what he's actually about. But, you know, the Colin Farrell character is not just a one-note guy. He's not just a one-note corrupt politician. You know, and this, you know, all the characters in this movie, you know, are basically kind of living up to the idea that sometimes, you know, morality has to be bent, you know, if you're eventually going to do good things, with not just with your own life, but for other people, and sometimes for society as well. And we see kind of a changing of the guard, if you will, you know, throughout politics in this movie that I think is really fascinating. It's exciting. It's beautifully acted. Like I said, it moves like crazy. And, you know, I think it ends on one of those really great, perfect notes. Just made me smile ear to ear at the end of it. I love the twists and turns this thing takes. It's one of the movies from Toronto that I could not wait to see again once it was over. I'm looking forward to it very much.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, I'm with you on this one, Eric. I think it's one of the best movies of the year as well. And I'm like you, not a huge fan of Steve McQueen. I'm a fan of old Steve McQueen. But not filmmaker Steve McQueen. I think the best movie he's made is Hunger, until this. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't a big fan of Shame. I wasn't a huge fan of 12 Years a Slave either. But this one is just, this, as you said, man, this just crackles on screen. I love the cross-cutting that he does in the first, like, 10 minutes of the movie, where he cross-cuts between the personal lives and the heist. I think that was really a wonderful choice to do that. And again, I don't know how many times we can say the cast is so great, and the twists and turns that it takes. I was on board 100%, and I thought there was a real, you know, these are really, you know, when you see a typical heist film, maybe not a good heist movie, but you sort of your typical kind of heist movie, there are a lot of stereotypes that are involved in heist movies, you know, and a lot of the characters seem one or two dimensional at best. That's not the case here, because their stories, their personal stories, are just as important and just as compelling as the heist itself. And that's what I think separates this from just like an average heist movie, because I cared about everybody in this movie, and I found their stories to be really interesting. And I thought that the Colin Farrell subplot was fantastic. And I thought, like, you know, he's got a couple of scenes with Robert Duvall that are fantastic. And Duvall's awesome in it. But that's Robert Duvall.
Right.
You know, but I like the relationship between, you know, the three women and then the fourth one who joins them. I thought that was intriguing. And as you mentioned, this is an absolute breakout performance for Elizabeth Debicki, because she's tremendous in it. It's a really, really great performance, and it's a layered performance. It's really good. It's also very funny. She's very funny in the movie, and I think everybody in this just shines. I think it's exciting. Daniel Kaluuya is terrifying in this movie.
Yeah.
Terrifying. There's a scene at Fireside Bowl involving him and Kevin J. O'Connor.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean,
great performance by Kevin J. O'Connor, too, by the way.
Of course.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's Kevin J. O'Connor. He's the man.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that they used Fireside. I don't know if you guys...
Yeah.
Yeah, Fireside Bowl. I mean, well, let me also say that he uses Chicago beautifully in this movie. And some locations, and he uses them on the west and the south side and some other places. But he uses Chicago really great, and Chicago becomes part of the movie. And that's another reason why I dug it, because it's like, this is definitely a Chicago movie. And of course, adding the politics, makes it feel even more like a genuine Chicago movie, not just a movie that was shot here. And it was also fun for me to find people that I knew that were in it. Like, one of my best friends is in it. And I had no idea. I haven't talked to him in a while. Steve Walker, who was in, you know, a bunch of plays with The Factory, and I directed with him. I was in Alive with him. He plays the reporter at the press conference outside, trying to push Colin. And Colin Farrell. That's Steve Walker, and I recognize he's shot from behind for the first couple of lines. And I recognize immediately when he said, "Excuse me," and he was trying to get his attention. I was like, "Man, that's Steve. That's Steve Walker." And I got very excited seeing that, and then spotting other people that, you know, you see in a ton of stuff, and it was just fun to watch that. But on the simplest of levels, it's a great heist movie, but it goes beyond that. I think it goes way beyond that. This is and I too love the ending. I thought the ending, it ended on such a fantastic note. And you really liked these characters, and you were interested in them. And I haven't even mentioned Carrie Coon, who has got a small role in it, but a great role. And she's, you know, she represents Chicago in a fantastic way as well. It was nice to have, even though her role is small, it was nice to see her, you know, coming out. And Michelle Rodriguez, who I've always really liked, she's really, really good in this movie. And everybody's got a great and interesting backstory. I think it's great. I think it's great.
And I should mention, because he'll be upset if I don't, our good friend Sergio Mims, there are key scenes in the movie that are actually shot, like, right at, you know, around the corner from his own house.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the whole heist scene, the firebombing of cars and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, right around the corner from his house.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, like, there's a sequence where, Sergio will probably tell you more about it, but where Colin Farrell takes a drive, I think, from the press conference, and they kind of follow his car.
Yeah, where the camera's outside the car as they're talking.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Sergio's neighborhood.
That's a great shot. Yeah. That's a really great shot.
And that was a fantastic choice, by the way. Interesting choice to just keep the camera outside of the car while this very intense conversation is going on inside the car. And that's right after the Steve Walker scene, because they get in the car and boom, it's one take. The whole thing is one take. I thought that was a really interesting choice, and I think there's a lot of interesting directorial choices in this movie. A much more interestingly directed movie than he's ever made.
Agreed.
So, yeah, I think it's great. I think it's great. Not a lot of people have seen it. I don't know what the hell is going on, but
no,
you should, because it's great, and it's Widows. So
you saw Ocean's 8. You owe it to yourself to go see Widows.
Yeah, that's true. All right, guys.
Fine. I will watch it again.
All right.
There you go,
guys. Hang on. Okay.
Happy to.
Hold on.
Okay.
All right. There's Eric and Jim. We're going to hang on. We'll come back, and we got the latest movies from this weekend to talk about, and that's right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And yeah, we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're back on a very wintry, stormy Monday morning here. We're keeping the track on that. on that weather situation that's happening. We'll talk more about that a little bit later on. And we got the movie reviews right here, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on in the morning here, as we do every Monday morning. All right, we've got the new movies to talk about right now. Jim Liskowski in for Colin Suter, and Eric Childress are here. And let's get back to the conversation. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back. All right.
Thanks again.
All right, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Robin Hood.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
Well, this is the 127th version of Robin Hood brought to the big screen. And this one stars Taron Egerton of the Kingsman films as Robin Hood, who is a young man, falls in love with Maid Marian, played by Eve Hewson, also known as Bono's daughter. And just when they're really, you know, developing, getting, you know, hot and heavy in their relationship, he is drafted into the Crusades. Literally drafted into the Crusades by the Sheriff of Nottingham, played by Ben Mendelsohn.
Wait, he's playing a villain?
Yeah, believe it or not.
Wow!
Yeah, believe it or not. So poor Robin is separated from the love of his life and drafted into the Crusades, and you know, doesn't go great for him. He's a great warrior and all that stuff, but you know, he doesn't like things that are being done to prisoners and stuff, including one more played by Jamie Foxx, whose son Robin tries to save unsuccessfully. But when he basically goes AWOL and comes back to England, he is followed, or at least found, by Jamie Foxx's character, and hopes to, you know, disrupt the government by, you know, stealing from the rich. We pretty much know the story right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, train him to be an even better warrior. You know, the movie, when you see the trailer of this movie, you see, like, Jamie Foxx is training Robin Hood to, you know, shoot arrows and stuff. He already shoots arrows pretty well in the Crusades, I gotta say. So, you know, what exactly he's training him for in the movie is I don't really know. But, you know, you have to have the training montage and everything. And, you know, so, and then he, you know, basically becomes Batman. He, you know, he takes on the role of Robin of Locksley, and, you know, by day he's Bruce Wayne, and by night he's Robin Hood, and maintaining his anonymity while getting cozy with the Sheriff of Nottingham, yada, yada, yada. His maid, his love of his life, Marion, since he was gone on Crusades and was declared dead, actually, she has taken up with a man named Will, played by Jamie Dornan from 50 Shades of Grey. And he also has interest in disrupting the government and fighting for the people. He just has different ways of doing it. All right. So the last time we had a Robin Hood movie in theaters, we had the Ridley Scott movie. And I'm very sorry to remind people that that movie exists, because I had pretty much forgotten that that movie existed over the last 8 years, or at least tried to forget, because that was one of those, we're going to tell the real story of Robin Hood, you know, as Ridley was on that kick where it's like, here's the real story of Robin Hood, here's the real story of Moses, and all of them sucked. And you know, and so that film was so excruciating and boring to the core that when you have a movie like this that at least is lively at times and is shooting arrows, and they're, I mean, arrows that can, like, go through concrete and stuff, you at least kind of, like, let down your guard a little bit and go, like, you know, okay, you know, this is really silly, but at least it's not boring. But it eventually gets boring, because that's basically the only trick this movie has up its sleeve. It's really fast arrows, and you're kind of using the same approach that Guy Ritchie brought to Sherlock Holmes, and that's not a good sign either. This movie is remarkably silly at times, very dumb at times. By the time you get to the second half of this movie and it's really trying to lay on the Robin Hood mythology, and not even laying it on very thick. It's all pretty very bland. But by the time you get to that point, you realize that the film has nothing going for it. It feels like the whole movie was just like a discarded pilot for one of those DC shows on the WB network or whatever that network is called now, along with Arrow and Supergirl at one time. Well, Supergirl's on CBS, but the DC universe that's on that network. And by the end of it, it even sets itself up for a sequel, and a sequel that is never going to come, mind you. But it's so unnecessary. It's so dumb. I don't understand what they were thinking and why, other than maybe Taron Egerton has some sort of, Kingsman made a lot of money overseas, and maybe they thought that they could plop him into a Robin Hood movie and they could make $300 million overseas. They spent $100 million on this movie. It didn't do particularly well at the box office here domestically, so we'll see where it goes from here. But this is just like who greenlit this movie project?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought when I saw the trailer. I was like, who the hell is going to see? Who wanted this movie and who's going to see it?
Yeah,
I mean, what are we talking about? And again, as you mentioned, Eric, I saw the first time I saw the trailer for it, that was the first thing that popped into my head. And then I said, I'm so tired of people aping the bad Guy Ritchie style. I mean, it's because it looked like Guy Ritchie's Robin Hood. That's exactly what it looked like. So, yeah, well, I'm not surprised.
No, thanks. No, thanks.
All right, guys.
No, there's no need for anyone to see it.
All right, hang on, okay?
Yep.
All right, Eric Childress, Colin Suter is off. Jim Leskowski is in. And when we come back, we got more new movies to review on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here in downtown Chicago, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And it's the movie reviews. My dad will tell a joke a little bit later on. We're going to talk about remakes, and we are, of course, covering the winter storm that is currently smacking the Chicagoland area around a little bit. So we'll cover that as it goes on. All right, let's get back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress and Jim Leskowski are with us. We're talking about the new movies, and let's get everybody back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Jim, let's talk about Ralph Breaks the Internet.
Okay, so this begins sometime after the events of the original, and quite an enjoyable Wreck-It Ralph. The titular game character voiced by John C. Reilly returns, along with his best friend, the glitching, candy-covered Princess Vanellope, voiced by Sarah Silverman. And they've sort of settled into a pleasant and comfortable routine of hanging out at all the same games, doing all the same things from sunrise to sunset, and pretty much just enjoying each other's company. For Ralph, it's kind of a monotony he gets to share with the best friend he's ever had. However, a wave of change comes in the form of the arcade's owner hooking up something called Wi-Fi to the arcade environment, and Vanellope's game, Sugar Rush, ends up being broken, threatening to permanently displace her and her fellow racers into the broader world of the arcade. So to restore Vanellope's home, she and Ralph sneak into the Wi-Fi onto the big broadband world of the internet, hoping to find a replacement part for Sugar Rush via eBay to save the game and the universe they know and love. Within the world of the World Wide Web are a couple of interesting characters, including one named Shank, voiced by Gal Gadot, as a tough-as-nails driver from kind of a grittier online auto racing game called Slaughter Race. And it's a place that Vanellope sort of wholeheartedly embraces, so much so that Ralph begins to worry that he's going to essentially lose the only friend he's ever had out in cyberspace. And they also get caught up in the spreading of a virus that threatens to break the internet thanks to our protagonist. So the question remains, well, will they be able to maintain their connection in the midst of all the chaos that ensues as a result of all their good intentions? Well, this is a Disney property, but again, there are some surprises here. I would say the first Wreck-It Ralph was pretty good fun, and it was a nice nostalgia trip that I think both kids and parents enjoyed. And, you know, a sequel was kind of inevitable, but really for me, like, the best kids' movies explore kind of these unexpected emotional spaces within the sort of expected brightly colored universe. And this one sort of juggles, you know, those tones quite nicely. I mean, for about the first act, I would say I was a little worried just because it was a little too silly for my own personal taste. Like, the setup itself was not the strongest, point of the film, but there is a turning point where I really warmed up. And it's fairly early on once Ralph and Vanellope enter the other side. I think the biggest enjoyment for me comes when Ralph gets sucked into the world of viral videos, and there's one huge laugh in particular involving a goat viral video that kind of destroyed me. And there's, you know, a nice sequence that followed where people suddenly start sharing these really weird, surreal videos, and all of that kind of brought a smile to my face. And there's a great turn of events involving Vanellope's involvement with a certain group of princesses, and some nice sort of crossover cameos, let's say, from various franchises that are instantly recognizable for most people. And then late in the film, there's even a little bit of melancholy when Ralph reads comments about his videos. And ultimately, there's a really interesting message about codependence, of all things, and learning to let people in your life do the things they want to do. And I think that's a really great message for the younger crowd. So, I mean, in terms of laughs, I don't think it hits the highs that something like Teen Titans Go to the Movies did for me earlier this year, but I thought this was pleasant and enjoyable enough with some good laughs and an even better message. So I'm giving this one a slight recommendation. I thought it was pretty much on par with the original. So if you like the first one, I think you'll like this one just as much, if not more.
Okay. I'm a big fan of Wreck-It Ralph. I actually really, really, really like that movie. I didn't like this one as much as the first one, but there's great stuff in this movie, and some really, yeah, there's some really big laughs. There are a lot of, once they actually get into the internet, there are so many jokes that are all over the screen, you know, because it's overloaded with stuff because they're in the internet, and there are like all these really funny little sight gags and jokes that are going on. And that sequence that you talked about where, Vanellope ends up in Disney, and because Disney owns every property in movie history, that's when all the crossover jokes start happening, and characters showing up from all these fun properties. And again, it's kind of overwhelming. It's not quite as overwhelming as trying to watch Ready Player One the first time and get all the references in Ready Player One, but it's very similar to that. It's very, very similar to that in terms of what they're going for. I think the relationship between Ralph and Vanellope is lovely, and it was my favorite thing in the first movie. And I have to say, Sarah Silverman does great work in these movies. Like, her voice.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, her voice performance in both of these movies is so, so good. And she's so wonderful and such a cute character, and you care about her. And, you know, when the gaps come between, you know, Ralph and Vanellope, I was involved emotionally because I like these characters very much. I think it's a little long. It's almost 2 hours, and that's pretty long for an animated film. You can cut a good 10, 15 minutes out of this movie, make it a little bit tighter. Some of the other characters, I wanted to see more of Jane Lynch's character because, there's not a whole lot of her in that. And she was in the first one a lot, but she's kind of replaced by the character that Gal Gadot, you know, she kind of fits into the mold that Jane Lynch fit into in the first one. But no, I think the animation is really good. And I found the big climax thing with at one point there are a bunch of Ralphs, like thousands of Ralphs. And I found that to be really creepy. Like just the way it looked and the way it was designed.
Yeah.
I thought it was creepy and exciting. So overall, I'm recommending this. I think there are statements being made about friendship here, about what you do as a friend, what is expected of you, what is expected of, that you expect of the other person. The statements about the internet are great. The whole comment section is great. And you know how people get obsessed with the internet and the way it's visualized in the movie, I think is very clever. So yeah, I'm recommending. I didn't like it quite as much. I think my main complaint is that I think it's too long, but I didn't like it as much as the first one. But I'm still recommending this because I think both of these characters, Ralph and Vanellope, are just really, you know, really wonderful characters. So yeah, I liked it. I liked it. And Eric, you didn't see it, right?
No, not yet. Okay. I'm looking forward to it though. Okay. I'm a big fan of the first one too.
Yeah, the first one was terrific. So. All right, Jim, tell me about, let's do Green Book. Tell us about Green Book.
Oh, sure. Yeah, this is a particular name that we all know and love, Peter Farrelly. This is his first foray into dramatic work, essentially, as a feature director going solo this time. He's known, obviously, as one half of the Farrelly brothers. And he creates this story inspired by a true friendship that, you know, transcended race and class at a very difficult time in our nation's history. We follow a classically trained piano virtuoso named Dr. Don Shirley, played by recent Academy Award winner Mahershala Ali. And he's about to tour the American Midwest, Upper South, and Deep South. And he's accompanied by Tony Lip, played by Viggo Mortensen, who is a racist bouncer from an Italian-American neighborhood in the Bronx, happily married to Dolores, played by Linda Cardellini, and hired as a bodyguard and as a chauffeur to drive Don on what is, you know, anticipated to be a rather tumultuous road trip. They have to rely on what was then known as the Green Book to guide them to a few establishments that were considered safe at the time for African Americans. And Tony knows how to effectively protect as well as persuade people, which is why Don essentially picks them for the job. But it's clear that they obviously have a lot of differences to look past and a lot of stops to make and a lot of lessons to be gained from the experience and the journey they're about to embark on. What begins as a story about two people with very different lifestyles and expectations and seemingly no hope of getting along turns into an excursion and ultimately a friendship powered by genuine understanding, respect, and love. So, yeah, I mean, you know, when you see the trailer, as one would anticipate, you know, the hypocrisies of segregation are laid out throughout, and Don is, you know, celebrated as an artist and then at the same time denied service at hotels, restaurants and restrooms, and you know these are, you know, are ultimately the brutal manifestations of white supremacy, which, you know, to some degree is still fortunately an issue to this day. There's even a small glimpse into you know, Don's homosexuality as well. So there's certainly a lot of layers that I personally didn't glean from the trailer initially. But I mean, when people use the word heartwarming, I think it is apt to apply it to a film like this, for sure. But at the same time, I also think it's a serviceable, entertaining crowd pleaser. I mean, I personally love a good road trip movie and a good buddy comedy. And this is an example of one that works quite well with, again, two great actors, sort of just creating very memorable, very likable characters. I mean, Viggo Mortensen sort of subverts his machismo that we, you know, obviously know him for and remember him from something like Eastern Promises. And he brings a lot of charm to this character. You know, he's not just ultimately just a brute who ends up caring about his traveling companion. And what can you say about Mahershala Ali? He is incredible and quite vulnerable here as someone who wants to be accepted, but of course, you know, be allowed to experience the bigger picture than what he's used to in the past. So I think the pleasure of films like this is that you know you're going to be charmed by everyone sort of, you know, being what you expect them to be, but There's also really good, authentic period recreations with great songs, great fashion. And I just think that ultimately the arcs of both of the leads here are very believable, enjoyable, and there's just a lot of positive energy. I mean, I will say it's a bit safe. It's a bit conventional in its depictions of prejudice. And, you know, it's certainly very familiar territory, but I can't deny just how warm and wonderful the performances are. It's the two leads in particular just have great, great chemistry. You know, it ends up being one of those movies that I can happily recommend to my family, and it's great for like a weekend matinee like I experienced. It's not a movie I'm going to be thinking about very deeply either, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think if you're a fan of these actors, you will have a great time watching them do great work. So I'm giving this one a recommendation for sure.
Okay, guys, hang on.
We'll take
a break, come back, and I'm going to tell you what I thought of Green Book. And that'll be coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Before the break, Jim told us about Green Book and what he thought about it. Let's welcome Eric and Jim back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you again.
Okay. I loved this movie. I loved it from beginning to end. It is, just right off the top, one of the most entertaining movies, just simply one of the most entertaining movies I have seen all year. It is human. It's really funny. There are a lot of laughs in this movie, in Green Book. A lot of them generated by Viggo Mortensen, who is hilarious in the movie. And what did he gain? Like 50 pounds for the role? He looks fantastic. And anytime he eats in the movie, it's hilarious. Every single time. And he eats a lot in the film.
It was like Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11.
Yeah, but to levels where you go, my God! I mean, the pizza scene alone. So anyway, now it's not like we haven't explored this, as you mentioned, Jim. It's not like this kind of thing has not been explored before.
Right.
Deep South, 1962, the relationships between African Americans and whites, and what the differences were culturally and everything, and. So this is not brand spanking new material, but the way that they go about it, I think is great. One, it's a terrific road movie. And I love, as you mentioned, Jim, I also love road movies. I think road movies are great. And this is a terrific road movie. And the relationship between these two guys is just stellar. Like it is so, I mean, it's so beautifully written and so beautifully acted. That, you know, you see the arc that these two characters, both characters are different people at the end of the movie. And from they were from the start. And you see that from scene to scene to scene and how they each grow and change independently and together. I'm telling you, it's one of my favorite movie relationships in years, these two guys. Like, to watch this relationship develop and to watch these two actors, my God. God, are they good in this movie? Like, they're two of the best performances of the year, and they work so well together, man. It's just, there are a lot of scenes of just, you know, two guys in a car, all right? Very simple. One guy driving, one guy in the back seat, and there are a lot of scenes of that, and every single one of them is compelling and fun and awesome, and you learn more and more about the characters as they drive through this time period. And again, I mean, you know, it goes through a lot of the same motions that you see with any movie that kind of deals with civil rights. But I just want to say this. My dad went nuts over this movie. Like, when it was over, he's like, that's one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. And the crowd that we saw it with, we went Saturday afternoon, just this past Saturday, the crowd we saw it with, you could feel the energy in that room. People were laughing at the end. There was applause. You could just, you know, everybody in that room was having a great time watching that movie. And I just felt like it was, you know, and again, you mentioned the soundtrack. The music is great. The supporting performances are all good. Like his family, Viggo Mortensen's family, hilarious. They're fantastic.
Yeah.
The guys he worked with at the Copa at the beginning of the movie, and then he goes into the diner for the hot dog eating contest. All of those characters, those periphery characters, are hysterical. Linda Cardellini is, you know, she doesn't have a ton to do, but she does it really well. There's a wonderful scene in the movie before Viggo Mortensen accepts the job when Ali's character calls up the house and wants to talk to her. And that's one of my, I thought was a scene that was really well acted by both of them. And there's a lot going on here. And the final line of the movie is hilarious and really beautiful at the same time. And it ends on that note. And everybody was walking on air at the end of the movie. My parents and I, we were like, oh my God. And so, I mean, I think this is great. It's one of the most enjoyable films I've seen all year, and I can't wait to see it again. I really can't wait to see it again. And, you know, if you're a fan of these two guys, and who isn't, to watch these two guys on screen throughout the running time of this movie is magic. It's absolute magic. So I loved Green Book. I thought it was great. So.
Eric? Yeah, it was one of those movies too, where I wish I'd taken like my mom and my aunt to see it on Thanksgiving. Cause I think, It's just like you're saying, it's the ultimate crowd pleaser.
Well,
it just gives you,
you know, that's
positive vibes.
That's how I saw it. My dad and my mom were sitting next to me when we saw it in a room that was full, and every single person in that room enjoyed that movie. You can tell everybody, like, not just enjoyed it, but really, really loved it. So I think it's great, and I just think everybody should see it. That's Green Book. Eric, hang on.
Okay.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll find out what Eric thought of it, what Jim thought of it, and what I thought of it. We're talking about Creed 2, which is in theaters now. And we'll do that after the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here until 5 a.m. We're going to be talking about movie remakes, good, bad, best. What are the ones that are better than the originals? We'll do that. We've had a spate of remakes recently. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. It's Monday morning. And we're keeping track of the winter storm that's going through the area as we speak, as we get closer and closer to morning drive. We're live, Allstate Skyline Studios. All right, Eric, Creed 2.
Okay, well, this is the sequel to the surprisingly great and successful Creed, which continued initially the story of Rocky Balboa, but the illegitimate son of his rival and one time eventual best friend, Apollo Creed, played by Michael B. Jordan. After the results of that movie were a few years down the road, and as the movie opens, Adonis Creed becomes the heavyweight champion of the world. And obviously this brings not just fame and obviously respect in his community, but also opportunities and a big challenge coming his way. Not the least of which is him proposing to his longtime girlfriend, played by Tessa Thompson. But across the way in Russia, the son of Ivan Drago from Rocky IV is on his radar and wants to challenge Adonis for the heavyweight championship of the world. The son of Ivan Drago, obviously coached by Ivan Drago himself, again played by Dolph Lundgren. And obviously Rocky Balboa is still a major factor in Adonis Creed's life. So this movie is basically, you know, taking us through the opportunity of Adonis Creed to potentially avenge his father's death at the hands of Ivan Drago as a new generation of the two men who fought in 1985 get to play out again some 33 years later. And this is a film that it's an incredibly high concept prospect what we have going with. No matter what your feelings about Rocky IV might be, I happen to really kind of shamelessly love that movie and all its ridiculousness. But it's a high concept prospect that could go a number of different ways, and the least of which would have been, you know, sort of what the way some people felt that the initial Rocky series went, that it was just a matter of coming up with a bigger, badder villain for Rocky to fight in the big, you know, in the climax, and, you know, kind of lost sight of, you know, where we began in 1976 a bit. But this movie actually subverts those expectations, while it is giving us the grandiose fight that we're looking for, you know, if we just want to see kind of a replay of Rocky IV, This is a movie that is, once again, like Creed, driven more by its characters than its plot. And that I was, this is the kind of thing that I was rooting for while I was watching this movie, you know, just kind of tiptoeing around each individual scene and watching to see exactly where they were going to take this storyline. Were they going to kind of go the route of, say, like Karate Kid Part 3, where, you know, he's got to, you know, Daniel's got to prove himself, but Miyagi doesn't want him to fight, and so he's going to separate himself from his mentor and all that kind of stuff. Thankfully, it doesn't quite go down that route. Is it just going to be a replay of Rocky IV? Well, a little bit of that and a little bit of even Rocky III thrown in for good measure. But again, from scene to scene, the characters in this movie seem to be reacting out of, you know, human instinct rather than the plot, you know, sort of jerking them in certain directions that we expect this film to go. You know, individual scenes in this movie I absolutely love. I love the proposal scene between Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson.
Yeah,
I think that's beautifully handled. There's scenes, you know, every time, you know, Sylvester Stallone's been playing this character for 42 years. On and off.
Yeah.
And 42 years later, you can still tell how much he loves this character of Rocky Balboa, because he's not going to fully betray him in any way. And as we saw how great he was in Creed and the arc that he takes in that movie, you know, we see him again. We see a real honest guy. We see a guy that really does care for Adonis, that, you know, he's still kind of fighting off some demons from his own past. I literally got the chills when he walks into his restaurant and sees Ivan Drago sitting there.
You know what, dude? The entire audience went, oh!
I swear to God, Nick, I didn't know. You know, I saw the movie with my mom, and I was watching, there were other people in the theater, and I didn't know where everyone was coming from in the theater, but I just sat there, and I just, this big goofy smile on my face, and was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the meeting you didn't know you wanted for the last 33 years, and I gotta say, and, you know, this might be a low bar, but this is actually the best performance Dolph Lundgren's ever given.
Okay, Eric? He's terrific in the movie.
He really is.
It's a terrific performance.
He really is. And, you know, and you consider that, you know, how many, he's only got like 42 words, I think, in Rocky IV.
Right.
And Stallone has the great, or Dolph Lundgren tells a story in the Canon Films documentary about when he got the role of He-Man in Masters of the Universe. And Stallone came to the set and said, "You gave this guy lines?" You know? and now here he is, you know, again, you know, some, you know, 30 years later, and again, it's, you know, other, I think other than one kind of moment he has at the weigh-in session with Adonis, I think other than that, you know, they don't turn him into not just a cartoonish villain. Again, you see that there is actually, like I said, and I think they did a great job with the son too,
who
doesn't get a lot of dialogue in the movie, but it was showing that What the Dragos have lost, what him and his father have lost over the years because of that loss in 1985, and there's shame involved. There's, you know, the son, you know, Drago Jr., has this sort of this moral complex that he wants to fight and get something back for his father. So he's not, you know, he's a big strong guy, and we're rooting for Adonis and all, but he's not the worst person in the world. I think, you know, these shades of gray that the movie puts these characters through, I think is what sets it apart from other, you know, type sequels, you know, in this franchise. I thought this was a wonderful movie. You know, it was satisfying in both a nostalgic way, and also I think is a great follow-up to Creed. You know, it might not be as good as the first Creed movie, but it's a pretty damn fine sequel, if I do say so. And if they do a Creed 3, I don't know where they'd go with it. But as long as it brings back these characters in the manner that they have in this movie, I'm there for it.
Yeah. Okay. Jim, what'd you think?
Well, if they're gonna have a Creed 3, maybe Clubber Lang. Maybe he had a son.
Yeah.
Who knows? But I'm with Eric. I thought this was pretty great, and, you know, there's a lot of expectation walking into this movie for me because I'm with Eric. I don't care if it's a silly, dumb movie. I grew up with Rocky IV back when it came out. Stallone was my favorite movie star at the time when I was about 7 years old. The Rocky franchise, Rambo 2, and yes, even Cobra. I have an affinity for that era of Stallone and for all things Rocky IV, including the ridiculous soundtrack and the insane amount of montages, training montages, and, you know, there's like even a sequence in Rocky IV where he's just driving and thinking about all the moments from all the Rocky movies, which is, I rewatched Rocky IV, I'm like, this movie's ridiculous, but I still love it. And so Creed II, when I got goosebumps and chills, man, when Drago appears in that restaurant, for sure. And just the dynamic shared between, you know, father and son, as well as father figure and mentor with Rocky and Creed. I mean, that is just something I will respond to strongly no matter what. And, you know, it's built on a very simple formula, not to sound like Randy from Scream, but, I mean, the sports underdog formula works. It works for me every time. I'm not even the biggest sports guy, but I love sports movies. So, you know, when I say there are flaws with Creed 2, maybe a little bit, maybe a few things could have been fleshed out more, maybe it could have been trimmed a little bit. You know, I obviously Ryan Coogler shot, you know, the fighting scenes even better in the original Creed, but of course Michael B. Jordan is great, and Tessa Thompson is great. There's a wonderful training montage and a lot of emotional investment that has really paid off beautifully late in the film. I got choked up. Again, because I have so much invested in this franchise, I might be a little biased, but I really loved Creed 2, and I'm giving this a high recommendation. And the Rocky franchise rules.
Okay. Let me just preface this by saying I do not have the same feelings about Rocky 4 that you guys have. Because I was older than you guys when I saw it, and I thought it sucked. But I have to say, I thought this movie was great. I love both of the Creed movies, and I was not looking forward to this because of the premise. I was like, oh no, that's really silly. But they pull it off. They pull it off completely. And a lot of it has to do with how good the script is and how they treat these characters in a three-dimensional way. The stuff between Tessa Thompson and Michael B. Jordan is wonderful. It's a really wonderful romance to watch develop, and what happens to them, and you know, there are complications to what happens between them. And I think Felice Rashad is terrific, and she's very funny in a couple of scenes. You know, and the dynamic between that family and how Sylvester Stallone fits in with that dynamic is really beautifully done. Stallone is so good at Rocky, man. He's just, you know, I think he should have won the Oscar for Creed. I really do. And I think, yep. I think he got robbed. Yeah. I don't think he deserves an Oscar for this one because he's got a little bit less of an arc and a little bit less to do, but he's still terrific in it, and you still love the character. And the relationship that he has with, you know, Adonis is wonderful. You know, the fights are good. They're not nearly as good as the way Coogler staged the fights in the original Creed, but they're great. They pay off emotionally, and everything builds up. And not only was it like when Dolph Lundgren first shows up, you go, ooh, there's another appearance, and I don't want to give it away.
Yeah.
There's another appearance by a woman in this movie. When she walked in, we all went, oh. Because I kept thinking to myself, what was it like on the set? Now, Stallone doesn't have any scenes with her, but, you know, it didn't end nicely for them. I had no clue she was going to show up, and I hope people aren't giving it away. Yeah. But when she walks into that room, I went, oh, come on now. Oh. But anyway, and the relationship between the father and son, I think, is beautifully done. And again, Dolph Lundgren rules in this movie. Like, he's really great in it. So, anyway, I'm with you guys, man. I'm giving it a rave, too. So that's three strong yeses for Creed 2. So, all right. Next week
definitely.
we have The Possession of Hannah Grace. I'm really looking forward to The Favorite. Cannot wait to see that. And then Burning is another one that comes out next week. So we got those for next week. Jim, thanks, buddy.
Cool. All right. Thanks. Happy to help.
Take care. Real quick, Eric, let's do a couple of quick thoughts on box office because we got to run here. Number one was Ralph Breaks the Internet. 5-day total, $84 million. 3-day, $55.6 million. Huge, right?
Yeah, this is people like to say the Frozen is the because it went wide on Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
but it was actually in one theater for like a week before that, so I don't like to count it. So basically, Ralph Breaks the Internet is the biggest Thanksgiving opening of all time.
Wow. Yeah. Creed 2, the one we were just talking about, 35.2 million for 3 days, 55.8 million. That's good also.
The biggest live action Thanksgiving opening of all time.
And it deservedly so.
Yeah, it's great.
Number 3, The Grinch, still doing really well. 30 million in 3 days. That's not bad.
No, it's doing fantastic business. Third weekend, it's actually like the third best third weekend for a November opening ever.
Wow. Then Fantastic Beasts, like we said earlier, not doing great here, but doing fine overseas.
Yeah, it's only $117 million here, so it's probably not going to hit $200 million in the U.S., which is well lower than any of the Harry Potter movies ever did. But it's already over $430 million worldwide.
Okay. And then, let's see, Bohemian Rhapsody, $152 million. Boy, that's a big movie.
Insane. This movie is on A Star Is Born pace, Nick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this movie is going to it's headed towards 190, has a shot at 200 million. It's made 420 million worldwide.
It's amazing. And then let's talk about the failure of Robin Hood. 9.1 million, mm-hmm. 14.1 million for 5 days. That's pretty much a disaster, right?
It is a disaster. I mean, it's a $100 million production, $14 million in the first 5 days. Like I said, unless they're thinking that they're going to get some international dollars out of this because of, you know where Robin Hood stems from, I don't know what Lionsgate was thinking in doing this.
Yeah.
And, they've been trying ever since Hunger Games and Twilight went down. They've been trying to come up with new franchises.
I see,
and,
yeah.
You know, they have, for every John Wick, there's a Power Rangers.
Right.
You know, and now there's a Robin Hood.
Right. All right. All right, man. Well, thanks a lot for talking, and we'll be back next week to review all the new movies. Thanks, Eric.
Sounds good.
Okay, buddy, take care. There you go. All right, there it is. Those are the movies and the movie reviews and the box office, and we'll do it again next Monday. Take a break here on 720 WGN.